You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, brought to you by Savage Arms and the new 110 Ultralight. At about 6 pounds, the 110 Ultralight is designed to combat elevation and the elements while maintaining the performance of a factory blueprinted Savage 110 action. The carbon fiber wrapped stainless steel barrel makes it durable and lightweight. The rifle comes equipped with the Savage AccuFit technology, so that means it's adjustable and it comes in a variety of calibers. The 308, the 270, the 28 Nosler, the 280 Ackley Improved, the 30-06, and much more. If you want to find out more information about the 110 Ultralight, visit savagearms.com.
Dan Picard, Adventure Bowhunter, is on the show. We discuss elk hunting multiple states, elk hunting strategies, his archery setup for hunting elk, and more. I hope you enjoy the show. You are listening to Tales from the Field, presented by Outdoor Edge. Stories, tips, tactics, and in-depth conversations coming to you from industry leaders. Let's get into the show. I am your host, Zach Harold, and today we have Dan Picard on the podcast. Really looking forward to diving into a little bit of his background and then talking elk hunting. I mean, I don't know where the hell the summer went, but here we are. It is almost halfway through August, and September is right around the corner. I mean, I'm going to Utah for an elk hunt the 22nd or something like that. And so elk hunting's here. How's it going today, Dan?
Good, good. Another day in paradise. Like you said, summer is almost over. It's hard to say, but I still have a lot to do before August 15th rolls around.
Isn't that crazy? I mean, some people are, you know, Nevada opens August 10th, and it's crazy to think that it's already here.
Yeah, for sure. All the scouting that I planned on doing, I'm going to get some of it done, but I'm just running out of time before all these hunts start up. So turning and a burning.
Right. Yeah. That's, you know, I definitely want to dive into, discuss scouting and things like that. But first, I kind of want to know just a little bit about yourself, Dan. Like, when did you get started into hunting? And is it, you know, something that's kind of passed down, or is it on the flip side, is it passed down, but you kind of took hunting to the next level by making it a career? Just tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah. So my family was a very outdoors oriented family growing up. So I was, immersed into it immediately and, fishing at 2 years old and, you know, shooting 22s at 4 or 5 years old. And, so I started early and I got lucky in that my folks purchased a place in 1990 in Northwest Montana, and we grew up in the country. And so we were hunting from the front porch, you know, and we're bordering Forest Service. So we had all this range to roam, and we hunted everything from squirrels to raccoons and, of course, coyotes and skunks and everything else that got in the chicken coop, and then of course big game in the fall. So Dad always took us on hunts when we were super young, mostly deer hunting. When we got a little older and started hunting, man, I was just thinking about this the other day. I think we used to each draw 3 antelope tags in Montana. You'd get either sex and 2 doe fawn tags. And we did that for a solid 10 years every year growing up when we were kids. So, you know, rifle hunting was mostly the name of the game. My dad did do some bow hunting on our property there where we grew up. But it was mostly rifle hunting and shooting and kind of the rifle realm of everything. And I didn't really get into archery and bow hunting until I was probably 14 when I shot like a white-tailed doe as my first big game animal, but kind of took it from there. And me and my brother got into hunting elk, and it really came down to one experience when, you know, I was probably 14 or 15, and me and my brother were out elk hunting in September with our bows and didn't really know what we were doing, but we had a close encounter with a big bull elk on the side of the mountain. And then I think the next week we called in a big bull moose that came into 10 yards and we had no idea. And this big bull moose came in and, you know, you got a bow in your hands and about dropped him because, you know, what to do. But those just close encounters with big game was a little bit different than anything I had encountered before as a rifle hunter. Right. And so that really solidified the passion of man, I just got to keep doing this, and hearing elk bugle and them being up close, and it hooked me from the beginning. And so that's kind of where I took off with it. And me and my brother kind of took it to the next level. And my dad, he still bow hunts a little bit, but he's a rifle guy, so he didn't really get too much into bow hunting.
Gotcha. So what, before we get into the elk hunting and things like that, what kind of, you know, steps, or what did your process look like to go from, you know, not really knowing what to do or what to expect, especially with a bow? Cause I think every bow hunter's been there, obviously. What did your process look like going from that to maybe where you are today, where now you do basically all the work on your bow, you build your own arrows, you test stuff out? You know, who did you reach out to, and how did you go from, you know, novice to where you are today, especially with your knowledge base?
Right. A lot of self-learning. I hung around bow shops a fair amount and kind of learned tuning. Of course, when I was a teenager, magazines and internet was, I guess, just getting going. And so, you know, forums online, that was a big learning resource for me on archery specific information. And I did a lot of just learning on my own throughout that time and on forums. And if I had a question, you know, I could go on a forum and ask a question or do a forum search and I could find answers. And a lot of it was just trial and error too, like on how to tune a bow. I struggled for a lot of years playing with, you know, the old bows, that the old wheeled cam bows, or lack of cam. They're just wheeled bows that broke over. And you know, I didn't know anything about timing or anything. So I'd pick up a used bow and it was out of time. And I remember about pulling my hair out trying to get an arrow to tune out of some of those old bows when I didn't know what I was doing. But it kind of evolved from when I was younger. I really took a close look at just all the technicalities of everything and all the tuning types and all the information that was out there. And it took me a while to kind of wade through everything and figure out what actually mattered, what actually got my hunting bow set up, like tuned and ready and shooting good for hunting. And man, I think it's just since I started such a long time ago and all that self-learning. And then after I graduated college, I went right into being a hunting guide, and that really helped. And I've always been a believer in experience is the best teacher. And, you know, you can shoot targets in 3D and all that stuff, but that really doesn't prepare you for a hunting situation, for hunting situations and shot opportunities on live animals. It's just so different. And so my mentality was, I just have to do this as much as possible if I want to get good at it. It's just like experience. And I say this all the time in magazine articles or any other seminars that I do, but practice doesn't help you for the game. It's an old Allen Iverson quote, if you ever remember basketball or follow basketball, but
yeah,
he's talked to some reporters and they wanted to talk about practice. And he's like, practice? Let's talk about the game, man. You get better by playing the game. Practice only does so much for you. And right. So it's just like anything. If you want to be a good 3-point shooter, you got to go shoot a lot of 3-pointers. Reading a book or shooting free throw throws or doing layups isn't going to make you a great 3-point shooter.
Right.
And so, yeah, that was just kind of the basic mentality. So I just, it was a challenge for me growing up, and it was so difficult. I didn't kill a bull with a bow until I was 18 or 19. It took me like 4 years of hard hunting in Northwest Montana to, you know, get it done on public land with a bow. And so those were some hard years of learning, but man, those elk are smart up in Northwest Montana. There's not a lot of elk, and hunting in that country really prepared me for hunting everywhere else, because I haven't encountered a hunt anywhere in Idaho, Montana, Colorado, Wyoming, that is as difficult as Northwest Montana is on a general tag. So all these other hunts just kind of became easier for me. There was just easier. There's more elk, more country that had elk, and you could see them. And so just growing up in those hard to hunt places, just super difficult to be successful up there, prepared me for success in the future. And then as I was a guide, getting on all those kills, basically, it's just one of those things. The more experience you have getting in on elk and getting elk killed, it just, after one, they just become easier and easier and easier. And by the time you're guiding and, you know, 20 years later and 48 elk later, it just becomes easier and easier. And so it's just an experience thing. And that's just kind of probably what led me to the job, was just, you know, it's all I focused on for several years there in my 20s. That's all I did. And being immersed in the guiding world and prepared me for, you know, where I am today.
Gotcha. How did you guide in Montana, or did you guide in Wyoming? Where did you guide?
Yep. So I was in Montana, mostly in Paradise Valley and out west of Bozeman.
Cool.
So yeah, most of my guiding has been in Montana, south central Montana there.
I got you. So, yeah. Kind of a little bit off topic, but was getting a position with Eastman's, is that what moved you into Wyoming?
Yes, totally.
Cool. Hey, I think that's a good reason to move, right? You get to do something that you love.
Right. And I was, you know, kind of the guide life, and it's more seasonal work. And I was working on the ranch that I was guiding on there at Dome Mountain. And so I was just mostly seasonal work. And after a couple years of guiding, and I met Jordan Brashears and started filming for him and hunting with him. And he'd worked for Eastman at the time for a few years already. And so that kind of got me, you know, the connection to, you know, meet Guy and Ike and do some work for them. And then they got me down here full time.
That's awesome. You know, so kind of diving into elk hunting and your season and scouting, first, obviously kind of in order of what you most likely do first is you do the research and then you probably scout if you can, right? So, typically do you hunt multiple states a year for elk, or do you try and focus just on Wyoming? What do you typically do?
Yeah. So, you know, I play the tag game, of course, and apply for all the Western states.
Right.
And usually don't draw anything. But
me neither.
Well, of course, my best odds are here in Wyoming as a resident. I'm drawing tags. So, I when I hunt elk, I always try to have at least two elk tags in my pocket, whether that's, of course, a Wyoming general at the minimum and an Idaho general or a Montana general. So I always try to have two. I sometimes have had three in the past. It depends on the year and what I draw. But out of everything, I prefer to hunt elk. And so that's what I try to focus on the most and get tags for the most are elk in all the states that I can. But, you know, you draw deer and antelope tags somewhere. And so you just kind of have to plan around those. And your schedule slowly builds. And then like my brother and Guy, they drew some quality elk tags in Montana this year. So I'm going to go hunt with them and do some filming with them in September. And so I'm not hunting for myself all the time, but if I'm not hunting for myself, I'm hunting with somebody and filming for Beyond the Grid or for the TV show.
Gotcha. As the season is rolling around, or better yet, I guess once you find out the type of tags you have and for what state, what kind of goes into play next? You know, you mean, let's say you didn't draw Wyoming, so you have an over the counter tag in Wyoming, and then let's just say that our luck is, it holds true. So you also have an over the counter tag in Idaho. What kind of goes next? Are you typically diving into research, or do you then try and go scout some more, maybe some places that you've already spent some time in either state? What's kind of the next step?
Yeah. Usually if I apply for a tag specifically, or, you know, get a tag for a specific area, say in Idaho, I have some sort of intel on that area already. And that could be from, you know, I deer hunted that unit and I saw a bunch of elk in September, right before September. So I was like, oh man, I want to elk hunt this unit. Or maybe a friend has hunted it in the past and was like, hey, you should go in here since you like bow hunting. I don't bow hunt. So go in here and bow hunt these elk. There's all sorts of elk in here in September. And so that's just a couple examples of, I have some bit of evidence or intel that, you know, tells me that there's going to be some animals in there to hunt. And so that's kind of where I start off with. And man, I mean, if I don't draw a tag and hunt in general, there's usually always plenty of elk on these places. And once you kind of have an idea of how to find elk and where to hunt them, you kind of look for those areas. And, you know, whether it's above tree line or, you know, the oak brush country, the brush country, or the desert, you can pretty much find elk anywhere, but you kind of find your style that you look for. And then you get tags in areas that cater to your style. And yeah, it kind of just builds from there.
Do you, when, say it is a general Wyoming, because that's the easiest for both of us to relate to. Do you try and find new areas or every year, or do you just kind of take your core area and start to expand that? Or do you start from scratch and go somewhere, you know, completely somewhere else in Wyoming?
Yeah, no, that's actually a really good question. So I have a couple core areas that I know is going to have elk in it, or I know they're going to be somewhere close, and I'll kind of have those. And sometimes I'll just hunt those areas depending on my schedule and not even explore anymore. But every year on the generals, I try to explore 2 to 3 new places. And, you know, a lot of that, you know, when I'm deer hunting, I gather a lot of intel early in September. And so a lot of areas where I deer hunt, there's elk too. And so that helps a lot. You know, my deer hunting just kind of cross pollinates into elk scouting as well. Right. But if, you know, I've gone into areas where, man, it just looks great and great country and the topography set up good for bow hunting. And I'll go in there and there's not one elk anywhere within 5 miles. Yeah. And so that happens sometimes. I would say more often than not, I can find some sort of elk somewhere. But like a good example, it was, you know, in Western Wyoming, and success rates, harvest rates were high. And I went in there and I didn't find anything. And then after the fact, I called the biologist and I was like, what is going on in here? And actually it was a game warden that I talked to, and he's like, oh yeah, that's more of it's a transition area, or like a migration area in that specific spot. And so you don't really have the resident elk that live there. They pass through there in October, and the high success rates come from the rifle guys. And so you just don't see as much elk there in September. And so, as you know, with elk hunting, timing plays such a huge role on whether or not it's going to be good hunting or not, because you can be in one spot one year and have just knock your socks off, fantastic elk hunting. And then the next year at the same time, it could be completely different. There might be some elk around, but it could be slow and you might not think it's that good. And so that's what makes elk hunting so tough. And I think where it differs from deer hunting is what I found. Because like deer hunting, you know, end of August, the 1st of September there, you know, when Wyoming starts September 1, you can go back to the same basins every year and find bucks, but not necessarily with elk in some of these different mountain ranges.
Right.
So that plays a huge role. Elk are tricky for that matter right there, is that they just move around so much and the weather dictates where they're at, and the rut activity in one spot might not be consistent from one year to the next.
Yeah, that plays into the saying, the elk are where the elk are, right? It's a frustrating saying, and you just want to kind of, when somebody says that, you just want to say like, what the hell, but that doesn't help me. but it is so true. Much like you, you know, I've hunted places where I go in there one year and there is elk screaming everywhere. And I'm like marking all these spots on my GPS thinking, this is good. I found a spot that nobody else is here. And then you go back the next year and you don't see a damn thing.
Right. Exactly. So it's that makes it tough. It really does. And it seems like that every mountain range is a little bit different, like on how the elk act and weather pushing them around. And so if you have goofy weather one year, an early storm, you know, you might find the elk 2 or 3 miles down the mountain from where they were last year, just depending on the weather.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Weather, water source, all. I mean, it's crazy how much stuff obviously plays into where they live. But if you really think about it, you correlate all the stuff that plays into where we as humans live. Maybe it's a little easier to think about it that way, you know?
Yep, exactly.
Back to the exact same scenario, you have Wyoming, which is obviously easier and closer for you to scout than, say, Idaho. So when it comes to wanting to scout Idaho, because there's no argument, you know, if you have the time and the resources or whatever, having boots on the ground is obviously going to be beneficial. And there's, you can't, you know, no one can argue that. I don't think the argument in lies with it being beneficial. I think the argument lies with, you know, somebody from, say, like the East Coast, just not having the time to come and scout. You know what I mean?
Yep.
So with you, and once again, say you have that general Idaho tag, are you trying to put time in scouting, or are you trying to go maybe a few days before season starts so that you only make one trip? What do you try and do in that scenario?
Yeah, it depends on the time frame that I'm hunting elk. If I hunt early, like first off opening day or opening week, then some of that August scouting can be worthwhile, but I usually don't do that for elk. Usually where I find bulls in August, they're not there in the middle of September. So their summer range and their rut range is different. And it's not for all cases, but just like in the Intermountain West here, I've found the majority of the scenarios are like that. Like elk just aren't there in September, or they're not there in August rather than where they're at in September. It's just different. So scouting in August or pre-scouting is pretty pointless as far as I'm concerned in most areas for elk. So I don't pre-scout elk usually.
Gotcha. You know,
how's that for a crazy answer?
No, I actually 100% agree with you. There's a spot that I hunted in Colorado that I walked in there one year with my buddy. The first time we had ever been there, no pre-scouting, and there were elk everywhere. And the following year, my wife and I and my son, we walked in there to pre-scout it, and we saw like two really good bulls in velvet on the way in. And that's basically all we saw. And yep. I went in there that year and saw quite a few elk, and I ended up shooting, you know, a raghorn or whatever. But, it just, in my mind, I was like, you know, I'm either going to come in here during season and there's going to be elk all over, or I'm going to come in here and I'm going to see a few elk. And I was like, I think I'll just not spend my time scouting for elk, at least in this unit. I think I'd rather just, scout for deer or something like that, you know?
Right. No, exactly. And there's always exceptions, right?
I mean, absolutely.
You have to look at the elk herd and the distance between the summer range and where they winter and where they rut. If it's a big distance, or if you're dealing with a big mountain range, then yeah, it's going to be super difficult to keep tabs on them. But if you're dealing with a small mountain range or a mountain even, and you know, they winter at the base of the mountain and they summer at the top of the mountain, usually you can find them in between. But some things I'll look for, kind of, you know, thinking about it, is if I'm hunting an area or if I'm deer hunting before elk season and I see like wallows from last year, or like broomers, like rub trees.
Right.
Those are probably like the biggest factors that I pay attention to, where, okay, there's a bunch of rub trees here and broomers that, you know, maybe they rut here and this could be a spot to check. So there are little, you know, keys to that, that I'll keep my eye on. But yeah, scouting is just kind of pointless for elk. Usually.
it's kind of a relief to be on the same page, because I'm like, man, there's some people out there that are putting a lot of time into scouting elk. And I think, once again, like you say, there's the exception. You know, I watch, say, like Ryan Carter, for instance, with DC Outfitters. That guy puts a ton of time into scouting elk, hanging cameras and all that kind of stuff. But he's also in a few units. He's in premier units, and for him and their hunting style and the clients and all that kind of stuff, that is obviously clearly 100% paying off.
Right.
Where me and you, where we might go hunt a general unit where everybody and their dog is out there walking around, we're probably going to get there and we're going to try and hunt where the hunters aren't. And chances are the elk are going to be where the hunters aren't also. Right. So it's like you say there, I agree with you completely. There's definitely an exception and a time and a place for it. But for definitely the topic that we're talking about and the type of hunting that we're doing, I agree with you. I just don't know that there's much point.
Right.
8 miles deep on horseback, wall tents, in September, chasing elk with archery equipment. That is what dreams are made of. Outdoor Edge is giving away a free Colorado elk hunt. To enter the drawing, go to OutdoorEdge.com and click on Elk Hunt Giveaway. Again, that is OutdoorEdge.com and click on Elk Hunt Giveaway. Now, let's get back to the show.
Yep, no, exactly. And you bring up a good point with that, because a lot of those Utah units that are, you know, very limited, and even, you know, in Wyoming and Montana, there's units too, limited entry stuff, where, you know, the bulls might be fairly close in proximity to the summer range of the cows. And so they rut kind of in the same area and winter in the same type of area. Like the breaks in Montana, for example, they don't really have a winter range and a summer range. I mean, there's no like mountain ranges. They don't go up high. You know, they move around. They're nomadic animals in the breaks, but there's no definite ranges to focus on. And this is a good example. Just a few days ago, I was up in the breaks scouting, and, you know, this unit, my brother drew it, and, you know, it's a highly revered unit. It should be great hunting. And I go in there and there is no elk. You know, there's no elk in here at all. And this is supposed to be a good area. And I'm like, scratch my head. And I'm like, man, maybe it could be one of these migratory or the nomadic scenarios where these bulls move in, because I was finding cows and everything. I'm like, they gotta be here. And I talked to a buddy that ended up hunting that a couple of years prior, and he gave me some great information, but he's like, yeah, there's no bulls in there in August. You won't find hardly anything in there. But for whatever reason, September 1st rolls around and all of a sudden bulls are popping up everywhere. So he's like, yeah, that's just the way it is up there. So good luck getting, you know, big bulls on trail cam. And in August, it probably isn't going to happen. They show up in September and that's what you have to work with. So kind of interesting. Like I say, every region or every state and mountain range just is a little bit different.
Right. And to that point, something that I've noticed is like you say, you go there in August and there may be water all over, right? But come September, there's only water in a few spots. And then all of a sudden that unit that you're in, maybe it's not a very big unit, is where the water is, and bam, there's your elk, you know?
Yep. They follow the water. Just, there's so much that can change. That's why I, once again, go back to why it's so difficult, is that they're just so nomadic and things change so much. And it's not just a static behavior, more so like, you know, a high country mule deer.
Right. Absolutely. Well, so kind of now moving forward, you have your area picked out, and you know where you're going to go. You head in there. And what I'd like to do is kind of talk briefly on the way you're going to approach and hunt your areas. So say you walk in there and you're hearing bugling, how you would hunt that. But opposed to that, you walk in there and you've seen elk, you know, there's elk there, but they're completely silent. And how you would approach that. Cause I don't know about you, but I probably see more questions either directed at me or other people or surrounding how do you hunt when nothing's making noise almost than I do how do you hunt when they're bugling their head off, you know? So with those two scenarios, how do you approach each of those, and what do you do in the instance of each of them?
So just kind of the areas that I hunt, my tactics have evolved over the last 10 years. And to answer that, you know, if you're hunting a timbered area and they're not bugling, your odds just go down the tank so much. And you're just like, okay, so my option is to sit on a water hole, sit on a trail, which, you know, may or may not produce, but those are like out of your control on whether or not they're going to produce or not. So quite frankly, my direct answer to that is I hunt open country. And so if the elk aren't bugling, I can still see them. They still got to eat. They still come out into the meadows or into the open to feed, whether it's sagebrush country or ag country. They're hitting the ag fields and then moving out into the sagebrush or moving up into the timber to bed. I can see them. They don't have to be bugling. And so that's the most direct answer. I stay out of the thick, heavy timber country. Just odds are better at killing elk every year if you just stay out of that stuff. You can obviously hunt the thick stuff and have great success, and I've killed enough bulls in the thick timber when they're bugling hard, but they're not bugling hard all September. So you got to adapt to that. And yeah, that's the direct answer. That's the key to success right there, as far as I'm concerned.
Right. And I, Dan, who knows, maybe you just like, after this, we've became best friends and we might have to do karate in the garage, you know, cause I couldn't agree with you more. There's times when I will hunt dark timber and I will still hunt through the dark timber. But much like you, if there's spots that because there are several spots that I hunt where it's like sagebrush, right? And if that is holding elk, then I'll spend my time hunting there. But there's not always elk there. So when I go there and there's not elk there, then I'm, you know, not going to just sit at home, and I'll try and still hunt through the dark timber or whatever else. And what I think is interesting about that is it's crazy how much dark timber and steep country swallows sound. And what I mean by that is, you know, you could be 300 yards away or 500 yards away and not be able to hear an elk bugle if it's really thick, dark timber. And same with really steep country, you know, they could, as the way the bird flies, they could be 200 yards away, but if they're up over and in the bottom of the next one, you're probably not going to hear them. And so I've found that still hunting through dark timber you know, I'll be going along and then all of a sudden I'll start hearing elk. And it's like, wow, how did I not hear these 150 yards ago? And I think, I think it's just crazy how much terrain can swallow sound. And once you kind of get in there, you might be amazed at what you hear. And then before you know it, you're able to start changing up your hunting tactics because now you can hear elk. You know what I mean?
Yep. 100%. Yeah. I mean, you said it. When I try to combat that or, you know, use my ears more, I'll try to just get on a vantage point.
Right.
And just listen and have that direct ear shot to as much country as you can possibly get your ears on if it's all timbered to help me pinpoint, because wandering around in the timber like that is, it's so difficult. And yeah, you could very easily walk by a rut fest because you can't hear over the next hill.
Yeah.
And so,
yep.
Yeah.
That's so true. And one thing, a tip that could be for anyone listening is if you have a camera with you and you have a shotgun microphone that you can change the amount of gain the shotgun microphone has. I tell you what, if you put that shotgun microphone on 20 plus decibels and you put some headphones in, it's amazing what you hear.
Absolutely. There you go. Yep.
It's kind of weird though. You can't really tell exactly where the sound is coming from. So that kind of makes it a little odd, but yeah.
Right.
So with, with the spot and stock style of hunting, do you find yourself wholeheartedly going into spot and stock mode, meaning you see a group of say 30 elk, the bull is something you want to go after. So you're on your way over there and you are silent all the way up until the shot, or do you try and get in, 80 yards and then do some sort of calling? How do you kind of approach that?
Yeah, I never rely on calling and I never want to tell that bull that I'm there.
Right.
If I don't have to.
Right.
So I hunt them like mule deer. If I can get up close and get an arrow in one without saying a word to him, I'll do that every time.
Right.
If I have a hurdle or, you have some sort of natural barrier or something to work with, I'll get in close and maybe hit a call. A challenge beagle to them or maybe a calf call. I'll do that, but I don't like calling unless I have to when it comes down to killing them. But like in thick country and I get in close and throw out a challenge bugle or a bull calling cow's bugle. If they're fired up, they usually come in.
Gotcha.
If you're using that terrain or the natural barrier, to your advantage, because these elk, they're so keen. Their ability to just pinpoint where you're calling from is incredible. And so you need terrain, you need something to get them to come over and at least look and see where that call is coming from, because they'll believe their ears, number one, but they'll believe their eyes over their ears if they can see where that call is coming from. And so if you're calling on the backside of a finger ridge, a bull will come up to the ridge and look down to where you're calling from to see where that call is coming from. And if he doesn't see anything down there, he's probably not going to come if he can see. And right. So that's why, you set up knowing that he's going to come to the crest or to a natural barrier and be able to look. And if he does come to that spot, you're ready for the shot.
Yeah. Yeah. That you couldn't have said that any better. I literally almost that exact scenario that you're talking about. I had a few years back, I was hunting up out of Cody. And this bull was coming across the opposite side towards me. And I, much like you just said, they can pinpoint sound so well. So I positioned myself in a saddle. And as soon as he came out of sight, I walked, 20 or 30 yards away. I made a couple of cow calls. And then I went back to where I was set up. And literally, as expected and as I was hoping, because it wouldn't have worked worth a damn if I wouldn't have, you know. But literally exactly what you were saying, he came over that saddle, headed towards the last cow call that he had heard, which made it to where he was, you know, slightly quartering to me, but plenty well to make a shot. And all of his attention was over there. And it's just insane how well they can pinpoint sound. Like, it's crazy. And I laughed when you're like, well, I just don't make a sound and I pretty much spot and stalk them like mule deer, is because I, again, literally the exact same way. I'm not good at calling. I'm really not. But I am good at spot and stalk. And I know, you know, playing into my strengths, I know that if I just shut up and don't make a sound, I have pretty good chances of getting in close enough to make it happen. And so it's just funny because I can't tell you how many times people have asked me, well, what do you do? And I say, well, I spot and stalk them like I do a mule deer. So that was, that was cool.
No, absolutely. There's no reason to make a sound if they're coming in or if you can see them and sneak up on them. Heck yeah. But it's funny, as we're talking, I was thinking about my Wyoming hunt last year, and it was totally different than any other hunt I've ever been on. I was in the backcountry, and these elk, you know, they don't get a ton of pressure during bow season. And I was cow calling, which I never cow call, just normal cow call. But I was cow calling because they're not afraid of horses back there.
Okay.
And it was just like right at the peak of the, like, I just caught them on the right day when they're just kind of rut crazy. And I had a couple tan horses and I cow called and elk, they're walking up to me.
That is so crazy.
Yeah. There's always an exception. Right. But this was a pretty rare experience. This wasn't normal elk behavior. This episode's going to be out on Beyond the Grid this weekend, actually on YouTube.
Awesome.
But it's a different hunt. The elk were acting completely different. You know, you got a big 360 bull that had a little spike bugle. That's another one. You can't judge a bull by his bugle at all.
100%.
But yeah, it's just very interesting. There's always an exception to every rule or anything that we're talking about. Yeah, you can cow call them in. Yeah, you can bugle them in. Yeah, you can be successful in the timber. But, you know, we're talking on the big scale, in the grand scheme of things in general, you know, what's worked the best for us. That's kind of what we're referring to, just so nobody is confused by that.
Right. Absolutely. So. Well, I guess kind of the last question before we wrap this up that I have, you know, pertaining to elk is, do you try and shoot a different archery setup for your elk hunting as opposed to maybe mule deer or antelope, or do you just try and keep it the same across the board for consistency and practice purposes?
That's a good question. I've kind of, my setup has evolved over the years. I keep it all the same.
Cool.
And it's based on my specs and my stuff. You know, I'm 29 inch draw, 70 pounds or 75 pounds or 80, depends on the year. So I have plenty of power, right? And so anything I'm going to shoot an antelope with, I'll shoot an elk with. And I guess I could go to a lighter arrow for antelope hunting per se. But, you know, I've shot elk with a 365 grain arrow, total arrow, which is super light. And I've shot elk with 490 grain total weight arrow and everywhere in between. And I've kind of settled with somewhere in the 465 grain total weight. I don't like a super heavy arrow because I shoot a single pin slider and I don't want too big of an arc or too much trajectory on my arrow flight. But it, you know, it's all about trade-offs. The heavier your arrow, the quieter your bow is, but you lose speed, right?
Right.
And then you shoot a 400 grain arrow, which is super flat shooting and super fast, and your sight tape is super close together on with your single pin slider, and you use a little bit of Kentucky windage and you're gonna kill them because you're set up shooting so fast. And so yeah, it's just a matter of playing with it and figuring out what works the best for you. But yeah, for me, you know, whether I'm in 430 to 465, I'll set it up. Depends on what arrow I'm shooting that year. Somewhere in there is fine and dandy. And I keep the same setup and the same arrows and the same broadheads for all species for that fall.
Gotcha. Cool. Well, wicked. Well, Dan, I really appreciate you taking the time out today to hop on the podcast. I've enjoyed our conversation. And at some point, you know, later on in the season or maybe after season, it would be great to have you back on and discuss the season and trials and tribulations and all that good stuff.
Yeah, for sure. No, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure. And I always enjoy talking elk. A little passion there going. I love it.
Perfect. Perfect. Well, thanks again.
Yeah, you bet, Zach.
Thank you for listening in. Be sure to like, comment, subscribe, and share. We hope to have you tuning in for the next episode.